Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Mike Adell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. We'll have a little Kansas news here in a few minutes. Our lineup today will be that and an exclusive conundrum being drummed up over the extremist conservatives in the Kansas State House this week, banging away at public education and at unions. Yes, Brownback Stan is alive and well at the Topeka State House. Our dearly beloved great leader, Governor Sam Brownback, and the Koch billionaire brothers are hard at work through their Alec Stooges, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council, drumming up they did total meltdown and destruction of the Kansas government, thereby hoping to bring in people, of course, of like mind into our fair state and turn it into a breeding ground of even further crazy red state reaction. Yep, we got a great show coming up after that. The full half hour latest of the Free Speech Radio news. And then from Oxford, England, at the college, Oxford Union, you will hear a professor dissect our recent... That's right, we're going to be moving into Africa now in a big way, our military forces. And subverting the economies and the countries in Africa. It's already gone on. You'll hear an analysis of that. Then our favorite, one of our favorite guests, repeat guests, Ray McGovern, will be on talking about the importance of recognizing whistleblowers. That's all part of the second hour, courtesy Robert Knight's 5 o'clock shadow from WBAI Radio. There you go, and we'll be back. I'll be back with the local news in just a minute.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A Dutch court has ruled that Royal Dutch Shell can be held partially responsible for pollution in Nigeria's Niger Delta. The court also ordered the oil giant to pay damages to one farmer. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Four Nigerians, backed by the environmental group Friends of the Earth, filed the suit in 2008 in The Hague, home of Shell's global headquarters. The lawsuit sought unspecified reparations for water and land contamination in the Niger Delta linked to Shell's oil operations there. In its judgment today, the court dismissed most of the allegations, but found the oil company responsible for one case of pollution. Human rights advocate Rosemary Okori tells FSRN that the case will encourage more claims related to the foreign activities of multinational companies.
With this verdict against Shell, a multinational, along many other things, will begin to change people who need to raise awareness about their problems will go a step further in bringing the requisite attention to their issues.
Critics say the judgment was mild. Shell had blamed saboteurs for the oil leaks, and the court sided with the company on 4 or 5 of the claims. Friends of the Earth has indicated it will appeal those rulings. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
The Zimbabwean Parliament is set to endorse a new draft constitution tomorrow. The document, which has been 3 years in the making, is expected to go to a nationwide referendum as early as March. If passed, national elections would follow later that year, potentially signaling the end of a continuing political crisis triggered by fraudulent elections in 2008. FSRN's Meshack Rusere reports from the capital, Harare.
Government leaders, including Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, are supporting the constitution, saying it will usher in a new era. Douglas Manzora is co-chair of the Constitution Select Committee.
We think it's a breakthrough. By going to the parliament tomorrow, we are happy as Zimbabweans because we know that if they go there, they are going to endorse the constitution making process, which has been the derailing factor all along.
The new constitution includes several controversial provisions, including presidential term limits and capping the power of the presidency, currently held by long-time leader Robert Mugabe. The new document also includes guarantees of press and political activity freedoms, but keeps a ban on same-sex marriage and upholds the death penalty. Misha Kruser, Harare.
The governor of Massachusetts has selected Mo Cowan to replace John Kerry in the U.S. Senate. Cowan was Governor Deval Patrick's chief of staff. He will hold the seat until a special election can be held this summer, but he says he does not intend to run in that race. Cowan's appointment means for the first time, two African Americans will be serving in the U.S. Senate concurrently. Climate change is already having a significant effect on wildlife populations in the U.S., and it's expected to get worse for many species. That's according to a new report out today from the National Wildlife Federation. Report author Amanda Stott says sometimes changing temperatures don't directly affect wildlife, but the indirect effects are just as severe. She cites the shifting range of the whitebark pine beetle.
What happens when you have these kind of infestations is that you have ripple-down effects on other species within that ecosystem. And one example that we highlight in the report is grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park.
Stott says the grizzlies have fewer cubs when the whitebark pine nut supply is low, and there are more conflicts with humans as bears seek out new food sources. As wildlife ranges shift, the report recommends governments and individuals ensure animals have pathways to move into new habitats. Community groups in dozens of U.S. cities rallied today, calling for big corporations to pay a higher percentage of taxes. This comes as another budget showdown is brewing in Washington that could result in dramatic reductions in social service funding. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Pay your taxes! Fix the debt!
About 50 people, including Karen Null, protested today in front of NBC's 30 Rock building, which is owned by General Electric.
We're here in front of GE today because CEO Jeffrey Immelt is on the board of a group called the Fix the Debt campaign.
Fix the Debt is a lobbying group of about 90 corporate CEOs that back sequestration cuts. The cuts are mostly supported by Republicans and would severely reduce funding to social services like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
They want to fix the debt that they caused by taking away benefits from millions of hardworking Americans.
Florence Johnson is an advocate for New York Communities for Change.
And we're here to serve notice on them that they can fix the debt if they just pay their fair share in taxes.
Pay your share. Pay your share.
The protesters are demanding an end to corporate tax breaks. They say shift the burden to working people. Meanwhile, Congress has a March 1st deadline to agree on a deal to avoid sequestration cuts. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Taxes. Pay your taxes. You don't hear the Koch boys saying that, do you, down there in Wichita? Them Koch boys, they don't like paying taxes. Nobody likes paying taxes. As proof of that, Brownback's going to extend the sales tax on the poor folk and the working people. Everything we buy is going to have a sales tax on it. We're going to have a city tax, village tax, county tax, state tax. Yes, the poor folk and the working people who can least afford it are going to be paying taxes on sales. Everything we buy. But those of us who make less than so many thousand dollars a year probably won't have to pay any taxes either. But the ones that make millions and billions, they won't pay any income tax either. Somehow they don't seem fair. They don't seem fair at all. You know, I think these people are operating on the spin factor. They're spinning stuff in Topeka. You wouldn't believe it. And they're spinning fear on the state level. Yes, the gun rubbers. We've got lots of gun rubbers out there. The Kansas Attorney General's office, Derek Schmidt, reported this Friday that it received 3,167 carry concealed weapon permit applications last month. The previous high came in March 2012 when 1,651 applications were made. This is almost like three times of what's normally going on. 3,167 applications in 1 month. 1 month. Talk about some scared white people. Oh, yeah. Scared white people. I gotta get my gun. Obama's taking my gun. Obama's gonna take my gun. Oh, yes, that beep. Socialist is going to take my gun. These people, man. What kind of crazy stuff? I'm going to have one in my pants. I need a gun in my pants. I'm scared. I'm not going to be defenseless. I'm exercising my constitutional right. I do not want to be defenseless. Mm-mm-mm. Boy, I'm telling you, it's a bad habit. These conservatives, extremists, these Tea Party people, are doing to the minds of the people, not only in Kansas, but all around the country. It's crazy. Why, earlier in the state, we had state legislators, men, warning that the women folk in the House of Representatives, women folk in the state capitol, who are senators and representatives, should have a male escort accompany them to and from the state house because of the big bad union thugs and the big bad protesters over the laws they're passing. Dude, sisters, they're jacketing. That's what they call it in the business. They're jacketing us, the dissidents, the peaceful protesters, the union people. Anybody that disagrees with us, anybody that disagrees with them that hold all the power in Kansas, we're being jacketed, straitjacketed, kept from being able to even peacefully protest without being stigmatized. And, oh, man, we had Representative Peggy Mast, a Republican from Emporia, going on how she felt like she's been bullied by unions. Bullied. She's been bullied. That woman, I don't think she's ever been anything but a housewife or a legislator. What's going on here, man? These people operate off fear. Fear of the other. It's pretty pathetic, man. Big, brave, pioneer Tea Party people passing these laws. Let's defund the public education. Let's defund the teachers. Let's defund the union. Defund them. We want smaller government. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, there is a spin factory operating out of Topeka like you wouldn't believe. Telling the women to be afraid. Well, you know, last year they called them thugs. People who were in unions, they called them thugs. Now there's, you know what started all this? Some guys got up in the gallery, and when they were passing laws they didn't like down there on the floor, some of them opened their mouths up and yelled, "No, we don't like that law." You know, talk about First Amendment free speech. Here's some guys up in the balcony saying, they yell, they get loud, and boo, they boo a law that's being passed. And, of course, the little nanny state, the little crybabies down there called security, and what did the union guys do? They filed out. Nobody was arrested. They merely raised their voice in opposition from the balcony about what was going on down there on the floor of the legislature. That's all they did. But that's too much in Kansas. We've got to escort the women folk, legislators, and have guards for them, call in extra Kansas Highway Patrolmen, raise the security alert up, put the terrorist alert meter up higher and higher. It's a thug alert. That's what they should call it here in Kansas, thug alert. You know, Bush had his terror alert and Cheney. Now we have thug alert. We've got a thug alert in Kansas in the Topeka State House, which you're going to hear more about. Coming Republican, a smart Republican who could take apart the numbers on public education, who's not afraid to tell it like it is. Coming up, that's right, coming up real quick, former Representative Bill Otto from my hometown, Leroy, Kansas, I'm proud to say. And I am really disgusted with the dirty, sordid tactics that these people are playing in molding public opinion against people who are dissidents or who just speak out against what they're getting away with. Because after all, what they're getting away with is destroying public education, turning everything into a private business, and letting the rich off with no taxes. That's what they're doing. And you know it. You know it. I know it. On to Bill Otto in just a minute. Thank you. Now, we're going to jump right in here. I had a little late getting the record button on. I was sort of, my little hot little finger wasn't getting ready with the buttons. To hear Representative Bill Otto tell it like it is at the State House from the floor of the representative. Here he tells me, like it is, what it's like on public education, what these guys are up to here in Kansas, in the Kansas legislature. Okay, you'll hear it. I'll bring it right up here right now. Bill Otto, just this week, I recorded it.
We've got Representative Bill Otto from my home district, my hometown, Leroy, Kansas. Yeah, if any of you are familiar with Representative Otto?
She got 47%, and I got 33%, and Willie got...
He's talking about Peggy Mass, Republican from Emporia.
So anyway, three-way incumbent race, and she had $3 for every one of mine, and she won.
Well, you know... I know you're sort of quasi-retired, but your strong point, Bill, was Otto, Mr. Otto was Representative Otto, was the way you, because of your background in public education, you seem to know the ins and outs of what's going on. And I wanted to lead up a question for our Kansas listeners about this recent report that Dave Trabert gave. You know, he's a representative of the Kansas Policy Institute, listeners, and I was wanting to know what you, off the cuff, thought about the influences of KPI and Dave Trabert there at the State House, and he's made some interesting. I sent you that report. I was wondering, I was wondering what you thought of it. Take your time.
Well, here's the first point. In that the Kansas Policy Institute says they're conservative. They're not. They are anti-tax. They are strictly a puppet of their primary contributor, which is, of course, the Koch brothers. And whether it's friends of the Koch brothers or directly or indirectly, the Koch brothers are the influence behind, and their influence in this legislature is huge. Basically, we basically have the best legislature money can buy now.
Right.
And here's the first problem is they don't like for schools to have any reserve of funds. They don't want a rainy day fund. They don't like it. They make a big issue of schools that are saving money. Well, out here in the rural areas, we have a lot of conservative school boards and administrators and are quite worried about from year to year what's going to happen. In fact, sometimes it's from month to month. The state doesn't hasn't paid the bill. And so you got to keep reserves to keep the buses running and the, you know, and the heat on and everything else.
Right.
So this is terrible, but that's not a spend it. I call it spend it or lose it. The first thing, that is really pathetic, the spend it or lose it concept. That's, to me, that is the most heinous thing that government has done. The second thing that I really disagree with him about is they go this local control. Well, I'm not against local control. Oh, this is wonderful local
right.
control.
Sure.
Well, let's translate it to what they really mean. What they really mean is, you know, we don't like this idea, this the Kansas finance formula that takes the wealthier school districts and shares the money, because we have a statewide mill levy of 20 mills, and we share that money over the over to other school districts, so that, say, Burlington, that now is in the 76th district, Burlington can pay 25 mills taxes and spend thousands of dollars more than, say, Galena, the poorest school district. And he didn't like that. He said, oh, we need to just let people spend their money for their kids. Well, that's against the Constitution. The Kansas Constitution says we're going to have an equal education for all students, regardless of where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And I get really aggravated, and it's one of those things where the, you know, I have considered myself a conservative, a true conservative, and one of the things is follow the Constitution. And it's like people get unhappy with the president and say, well, he's trying to get around the Constitution. Well, I want him to be as equally unhappy with our governor and legislature who doesn't want to follow the Kansas Constitution.
Exactly. You know, and I'm with you because our North Jefferson County School District, you know, there they've saved a little money up too, and it's just a pound wise, a penny wise, pound smart or something. But I mean that's the way you
pound foolish, yeah.
Pound, yeah, but you got to be that way out here because you get into this up and down stuff, this craziness going on in the State House, Representative Bill, and it makes the parents and the people and the school board. It's an unnerving thing. It's not a good thing to make the little people out here in these rural areas, the rural school districts, fret all the time about what's going on in the State House. You know what I mean, Bill?
Oh, my. And to me, it doesn't make any difference. It's like the governor says, well, we're not going to have any forced consolidation. Well, you know, If I have my choice of just being shot or starved to death, you know, I think probably shot would be a better option. At least it's over quick.
Well.
You know, this is just, and this is what they're doing. It's like, in fact, Kansas used to have where you were required, back traditional Kansans ran by sane people, we used to require 6 months in reserves. That was the requirement.
Right.
And
I did not know that, but actually that just makes good Kansas sense, if you ask me.
Carried us right through the Depression. They called it the 18-month budget, and that you figured how much money you had, and then instead of divided it by 12, you divided it by 18, and then you could only spend 2/3 unless you got special permission. But you had money in the bank.
Right.
And so school districts didn't have to worry how they were going to keep the lights on or if the state was going to bounce the checks.
God damn, that's a hell of a way to look at it.
Well, it is.
It could be. Really? You think there have been times where the state would bounce the checks?
Oh, yeah, there's been times, yes. There's been several times the last several years where the state was short of money and they just told the school districts, well, I know it's illegal, but you know it's a violation of cash basis. But you're going to have to just use your capital outlay or whatever funds. Now the funds still stayed there, but it's like whatever funds you got to pay the bills. And they basically admit that they have to violate the law.
Oh my God. Well, you know, this disparity, I think that people, I like smart conservatives. I think intelligent conservatives are hard to find nowadays in Kansas, at least in positions of power. But
some of the most conservative people are actually the rural Democrats. I mean, you know, Dennis McKinney used to be very conservative.
Fiscally. Yeah, you're right about that. I can get along with a guy that's fiscally conservative. That makes sense to me. But, you know, it gets under my craw a lot when they start talking about the disparity between the big school districts and the little school districts, and they talk about school choice and stuff. Now, all we got out here is these empty old parochial schools, and there's a lot of people out. Well, I wouldn't even say that. There's maybe 10% of the people out here would like to see those old parochial schools reopened. They're religious schools, too, which I object to in that sense. I mean, if you can afford them, I mean, if you're rich, why not? If you're rich and you can afford the tuition, put them in there, put your kids in there. But, you know, we got to have public schools for everybody, What do you think about
that,
Bill?
Right, and that's correct. And the Kansas Constitution says that we cannot do that. We cannot fund, and I don't care what games you're playing, tax credits or whatever. Again, it goes back to the Kansas Constitution. We cannot fund parochial schools. And we have probably the best choice that I think of anybody in the United States. You can go to any school district. A student can get out of the other outside district can refuse them, but in rural areas, that you know, if you want to go to one school and go to another school, you can. We have virtual schools to where parents basically, which amounts to homeschooling, that publicly funded. They only get base. I mean, it's a good deal for the state, but so it costs less. But we still have those. You can have charter schools, but they're through the board. And frankly, I wish we could give city people a little more leeway in charter schools.
No, excuse me for interrupting you, Rep. Otto, but I mean, you said that in your email, and I was wanting to know why do you, I mean, it's okay. I mean, I guess. I mean, why would you make that for the urban cores?
Well, the reason is, it's like, for instance, we're out in rural areas where we can go from one district to another.
Right.
I know, for instance, I had grandchildren in Piper School District, and Piper is on the edge of Kansas City, Kansas, and Piper has said no more. That you can, if you're in, you can stay in, but we're not going to allow any more students. So if we could do something to where if neighboring school districts were not allowing, if they weren't allow people to allow, particularly one that made sense to me and they tried was the Roe versus, not
Roe v. Wade, buddy.
The Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah, right. There you go.
You know, they're wanting that school, and they're wanting a charter school, and kind of a commemorative thing, and in Topeka. And the trouble is that and it's not that bad. I mean, it isn't that bad. They can still go virtual schools. Like I said, they can still say the money follows the kids. And it's complicated to try to tweak it so that it's fair to everybody. But we could stand to tweak that. And even the Obama administration has penalized us because we're a little too restrictive there on we couldn't compete to race to the top. But
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a good one, race to the top.
Yep.
No child left behind. And so we want to seek to enter you know, a lot of people say that competition is sort of the root of evil in terms of education, and I sort of think about that myself a lot, but then we get Obama changing it to a race to the top. I mean, we got no child left behind, and we got race to the top. Well, I mean, what is it? We're talking about teaching our kids.
And, well, it's almost the reverse to where we will give you more money if you do these things, which to me comes back to my constitutional issues.
Yeah.
Where you have to remember, basically, No Child Left Behind was cooked up by Ted Kennedy and George Bush.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
Sounded to me like it's something that came out of a beer stomach.
Right. You know? Hey, you know, Traybert with the Kansas Policy Institute, I was reading them papers that I sent along to you, and, you know, he claims that each kid in Kansas is getting $12,000 rather than four. How does he come up? How does he come up with that figure, frankly?
He is taking everything. He's counting the lunch program. He's counting summer school. He's counting all funds, and that is correct.
Well,
but you know,
so
transportation.
Now, isn't there a big part of that federal funding too?
Oh yeah, he's counting all funds, federal funds, the state funds, all funds, local. Anybody that gets a few donations and stuff, it all goes into the amount, and that is about right. Now, the problem was, and I carried the amendment in 2005. The far left was wanting a lot more money. Far right didn't want to pay anything. And so I looked at what the Senate. I looked at what the Senate came out, and it's like as a freshman legislature, that's pretty good. I can carry it on the floor, and I took that down, and that eventually became long story of Parliament. It didn't. The amendment died on final action. But once we saw the path, that was the path. That was the amount. And you hear these people, we don't know what a suitable education is. It's like, yes, we do. It was passed by both houses in 2005, signed by the governor, and unanimously agreed to by the Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
Problem of it is the conservatives have held power from that point on, and they just never have funded it.
Well, now, when you say conservatives, I think you're referring to a different breed of conservatives than...
Oh, yeah. conservatives.
Yeah. Some call them neo-conservatives. Lately, I've been calling them since Governor Brownback's State of the State speech here just this couple weeks ago in January 2013, neo-Confederates, because he said we were going to Texas. I don't know if you heard
right.
The state, but we're going to Texas, no income taxes, and I don't know how we're going to fund our public schools. You know, what do you think of this? Bill, I think you're older than me, but I don't mean that in a bad way, brother. But I mean,
that's all right.
But, you know, when I went to college, I come out of Leroy High School, you know, the tuition was just like, dude, I mean, like a couple hundred bucks a semester. And if you passed, you know, if you had good grades and stuff in high school, it really was sort of a meritocracy. If you could, you know, if you were smart and passed your ACT at that time, a test, you could go to college for, you know, basically just figuring out a way for your room and board. You could you didn't have to go to debt and get no loans to pay off any higher education. And I just think, and I'm hearing all this stuff about these student loans and stuff, you know, how come we are in this situation in Kansas? I think it'd been much better like it was 30, 40 years ago, where if you're a smart guy or a smart girl, you can get to college basically almost tuition free, you know, as long as you can figure out your room and board. You know what I mean, Bill?
Oh, I know what you mean, and it has griped me at how the legislature is so picky at K-12.
Uh-huh.
You look at my little Allen County, and I don't know whether you went. I went to Allen County.
I played there, yeah.
And we had the president, and we had Dean Brown, and that was it. That was the administration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the school has not really grown that much, and we have vice presidents and deans and all this stuff. Now, it's still fairly reasonable at Allen County, but the tuition hour rate is about what it was for the entire semester, most and all, when I went.
Right.
And I could go, and I know why. It's like I did roofing. And I could make enough money
right.
in summer
right.
roofing because I got paid $15 a square, and I could make enough money roofing that I didn't have to work during the school year.
Right, I hauled hay. That's what it was.
Yeah, hauled hay. Y'all did a little bit of that too. But if you could make money. Well, now you'd have to have a terrible good job because I got my last kid is at Pitt State.
Yeah.
And tuition and books are about $4,000 a semester.
That is unbelievable to me. Unbelievable. And I got a 15-year-old coming on me, and he's as smart as a whip. But I don't know. You know, I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't want to put him in debt. And it's just something. And we're talking about Kansas and the Constitution, education for all. And I think we've lost our way somewhere, Brother Bill. You know what I mean?
I definitely know what you mean. Well, I tell you what. Here's what I call the people. They are basically deadbeats.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Kansas is deadbeats. And something I fought and fought and fought is this capital restoration. And roofing is something I know, but it's like, but they're sitting there, they're going to re-copper the dome. Well, gosh, you could get a plastic polymer that would never wear out.
Yeah.
That would look just like the copper if that's what you want. And it would have been cheaper. But no, we got to do it exactly the way it is. And
what is that? It was $430 million last time I checked. Am I
right?
Sure,
it's going to be the biggest capital. It's already in state-wise. I think it's going to beat the federal Capitol building. And it's borrowed money. These people don't care about if they borrow money. That's fine. It's like they don't care about fees. Well, we swept $5 million. I didn't vote for a budget the last four times because, A, I didn't want any more borrowing money on the capital restoration, and, B, I don't believe in sweeping funds because if you're taking fee funds, doctors, lawyers, everybody pays fees into the state for their licensing. And then if they have any money left at the end of the year, the state then steals it and puts it into a general fund. That, to me, then, that says that's a tax. But all of these people that call themselves conservatives say, well, no, I've never voted for a tax increase. Well, yes, you have if you've approved fee increases, and then you've stole the fees that people are paying in to run their professional licenses.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
That is a tax then, and that's what they're doing.
Well, I'll shift this a little bit more, stick the knife in deeper, not to you, but to the listeners. What do you think of the sales tax? I mean, they're talking, how can Governor Brownback decrease? First off, can he do it? I don't think he can. He's going to keep the sales tax up. Ain't that sales tax regressive? Ain't that hard on the poor people?
It is regressive, and I voted for it, and I just about went home and cried about it. I would have supported actually Anthony Hensley, the Senate minority leader, wanted to raise the tax on the higher income, and I was supportive of that. But that was the only choice we had, and what got me is the budget had already been passed. We had spent the money. It was signed on the governor's desk, and then it was just a matter of who was going to have to take the bullet.
Yeah, that's Parkinson, Governor Parkinson, that brought that up. Yeah.
And now extending it, but it's like there's worse things. My gosh, they're talking about eliminating a whole bunch of things, such as the your tax credit or your
home mortgage
and local property taxes.
How are they going to do this, Brother Bill? I don't understand it. It don't make no sense to me mathematically even, and I'm no genius on this, but
it makes sense to you. You got to have money to run the state. We have paid off the large corporations, so we've eliminated corporate income tax that I clearly did not vote for. And we've cut our income of 30% of the state, and so now we've got to try to balance the budget. And
so it's going to come down to the teachers and the cops, the firefighters,
yeah.
You think? It's going to come down to playing around with the 401ks of these people, or
we settled the CAPERS problem at the last time. We've got it. We had a good bill. Now the problem of it is, again, will they fund it? Well, these people probably won't. They just won't fund anything. They love to bond money, which is another thing. How do you bond money for roads?
Right.
And then take it out of KDOT. Well, to me, bonded money for roads, taking it out for operation is violating the cash basis law.
Hmm.
But where nobody goes to jail and there seems to be no penalty on it.
Right.
These people just ignore the Constitution, ignore the law, ignore the minimum balance, and they just do whatever they think they want to do.
Well, they're doing it.
Right now.
They're doing it.
I think it's going to be this way for the next couple of years, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's going to be that way. And their goal is to get through. They know they can't get through anything past 2 years. Their goal is to eke out the next 2 years on the reserve, because basically that Parkinson tax and the things that we have done in the 8 years that I was there put us in a financial status to where we were back on the road to recovery and building up our balances. And then what's happened is they're going to spend down those balances down to nothing and try to get past the next election without big, horrendous tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, they put it on local people. Before I went to the legislature, we had what's called the demand transfers. And from the very first time Kansas had a sales tax, a part of that sales tax was to go to local governments for property tax relief.
Right. I remember
that. And
they
quit it. We have lost a total, and up to last year, it was $1.8 billion that is not going to local government that should have. And that's not counting schools.
No, that's city councils. And
that's the city councils and
county commissioners.
And what they'll do is they'll probably take road money. They'll probably take alcohol treatment money, which we desperately need. our mental health, it's like we privatized this stuff, and then we just say, well, you know, I guess you'll just have to figure out how to fund it. And they're putting more and more on local governments. And to me, then that's the ultimate insult. You're putting more on your property tax and then turn around and say, oh, by the way, and then you can't take it off of your state income tax.
You know, I don't know about Leroy anymore. I mean, I do, but I don't know about the doctor situation. But today, it's Wednesday, January 30th, and they're having a big display up there at the State House today about underserved. Well, you know, there's like estimated 255,000 people in the rural areas who can't get to doctors, or if they can, it's so limited they can't take off work. It's amazing how much the people in the big cities and in the State House underestimate the what I consider poverty of medical care in our rural areas. I mean, we've got two doctors here in North Jefferson County. They're nice guys, I'm sure, but they're the only two guys. And we get one town in Nortonville. They 2 days a week, 3 hours a day. That's 6 hours a week they're in that clinic up there in Nortonville, and that's just not enough. And you know, there's a bunch of people that are getting they're not getting their dental exams, eye exams. They're not getting their they're not getting cancer screens, routine stuff that you should do, physicals. Good general practice medicine is not being practiced in the rural areas. It's just hard to. I mean, it's just I'm sick. You know my personal connection to that,
mm-hmm.
And I am really sick of our rural communities being overlooked and underserved. That's the word, underserved. And I see people, old people, figuring out ways to two things: pass off their property and go bankrupt, and then go into the nursing home and die. I mean, that's a horrible thing, if you think about that, that these people are trying to figure out a way to spend their last couple years in a nursing home and die and not lose everything they got on the way there. That's a sick statement about our society, and I'm just madder than hell about that, Bill.
Well, it's two things. It's the perfect storm. In that expansion of with Obamacare. They've expanded the scope of people that are going to be treated, but yet the Supreme Court ruling said, okay, you could do this, but you can't make the states do it. So basically what's happening is, particularly in rural areas, even in Coffee County, which we've got Wolf Creek and we've got Coffee County Health Systems, part of it is the Waverly Nursing Home. Well, they're seeing, they're are trying to get rid of the Waverly Nursing Home out of Coffee County Health System because they're not going to be able to make it pay.
Right.
Because the feds are not going to pay the reimbursements, and the state is not going to pay the reimbursements. So we're almost in the perfect storm in that we have a state government that is deadbeats, and the federal government that is wanting to expand coverage but are not really sending the money to expand the coverage. And I am really concerned. It's really what is going to happen in rural areas. Now, as far as doctors in Coffee County, and we've expanded where we go down and we operate a clinic in Woodson.
Yeah.
But you look at over at Chase and some of the other areas.
I'm sure. It's mad.
It's a dentist, my word, we're, you know, trying to keep dentists. We don't have a dental school in Kansas. And we are behind the eight ball in dentists, and people don't realize the critical problems with your teeth. I mean, you get an impact of teeth, it's only a couple inches from your brain. I mean,
well, that might be what's going on at State House.
I think so. I think that some of my, but they're just people. It's like, the same thing in Washington. Both sides, they're just happy to get the credit card out. And nobody wants to pay the bill. Well, sometime we're going to have to pay some bills. And like all that capital restoration, and that is the biggest thing. What a waste of money. We could have much better spent that money on rural health care. Maybe we could have put a dental school for that.
Well, I'll just run this by you. I think our here's the socialist in me. I want to get under your skin now, and the listeners. I think our county health departments should be like what's going on and has been going on for 50 years in England and Europe. You can go in there and you see those people, and if you need it, you get it. There's no bill collector. It's just done. And yeah, I'm for universal health care, and got to tell you, Brother Bill, I'm seeing what you call a perfect storm. I see that happening in this country, and it's a tragedy to our neighbors, and there's just no excuse for it, if you ask me, brother. That's why.
Well, to me, it's the worst. What happened was this was the worst,
No, I want to interrupt you. I know my wife and I. We lived out in Pottawatomie County for 4 years. You know, there should be something like the Peace Corps for doctors, you know, where you get you a good medical education at a big discount, and you go out and work in the countryside, but you don't just go out there and do it for 4 years. You get it. You know, her and I got a hankering at, we both come from rural areas, and she didn't want to go back from the city after the big city. But after we got out there, we sort of liked it, and You know, we need something like a Peace Corps for the country people, and we need to bring young people. You know, we need to help take care of these young people that are in our rural communities and bring more back. We need, you know, like the old Kansas is founded by smart white people to help fight against slavery. We need to bring back the smart. We need to bring back the smart. Conservatives, the conservatives have left, and the liberals have left Kansas, and the young ones. We need to bring them back and to our rural areas, and that's where I'm at, brother. I'm telling you, I'm letting all the listeners know. I'm gonna play this. I ain't cutting it out. We need to bring people back into Kansas, and it ain't like Brownback offering discounts and all that stuff. Well, hell, we'll take advantage of that, too. But we need to bring our smart people back and take over the state again and make it like it used to be. That's why I look at it. I'm sorry, brother. I had to stick that in there.
Well, the one thing that I have been very supportive that Brownback did was people that moved back to rural areas that had lost population in the last census.
Yeah.
Woodson County is one of them, and I don't know about your area, but you could come move back to Kansas and 5 years not pay any Kansas income tax.
Yeah, well, he's trying to make it where nobody pays income tax.
Well, he's trying to do that, but it's like he's got
come on, get it straight, Sam. Come on, get it straight.
And it's one of those things where he's hoping, and then we do have, we're having a little increase in the oil production, but I don't think we're going to reach Texas. You know, if you look at Texas and Oklahoma and say, well, that's a good example. Well, sure. You know, when you can support a good percentage of your budget on oil money.
Jesus.
And, you know, every state isn't the same. It's like, there isn't any in Alaska either. But you look at most of these states with no income tax, and they've got a lot of oil. You got to pay the bills. That's the biggest thing.
Here's paying the bill, brother Bill. Off the record, while the tape's running, do you think we could get Governor Sam Brownback to go sign a contract with Fox News like Sarah Palin did? Do you know that Sarah Palin? They just let her go. I'm being polite. They let Sarah go, and there's an outfit called Smart Politics that computed how many words she said in interviews. It come down to $15.83 she got paid per word on Fox News. No kidding.
Wow.
I wondered if we could bribe, maybe we could get Rupert Murdoch to bribe Governor Sam Brownback to go work for Fox News and leave us alone.
Well, that's a good idea. Anything that would work.
Do you have what's your health insurance? I mean, that's another one.
I paid since I'm keeping the same health insurance.
Yeah, well, I hope you are because it's better than most. Help me out.
I had to go to a $2,500 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cost me $1,200 a month because that kid is.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
And that's for $2,500 deductible.
And you know, there's a lot of people paying that right now.
When you get, I will be 65 in July.
Sir. Yeah.
But then my wife is 5 years younger.
Uh huh.
And I got to keep something on her.
Sure. But you know, this is my thing, man, about the county health department, the Peace Corps, or Doctor Corps, whatever you want to call it. You know, I really think we've got to go this way. This is the way it should be. It's the way it is in most countries, and not just Europe. Hell, it's that way in Brazil, all over the world. There's we just got a big emphasis on health care instead of the military. And I don't know, Brother Bill, I just so appreciate you giving me your candid remarks about the State House. I want you to run again, Bill.
Well, I'm just trying to decide what I just can't for me right now. I'm thinking it only takes about 500 people to get to run as an independent, and I'm really considering that because I'm very disgusted with party politics. And like you, go back to your health care, I see too much of what's happened is we're having insurance companies that are really calling the shots there.
Sure.
And, you know, they're the ones that are making the profits.
And they're lobbyists. Hell, they've got lobbyists.
Oh, my. Sean Hannity, which he's so sometimes that I can't really stand him, but guy told me to watch Boomtown. And he had a special on how much the lobbyists have ramped it up in the last few years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to where it's not a red state, blue state, it's green. And it's money, and it's like the worst ruling that what is the Citizens United case, to where people can corporations are individuals, but those individual limits on how much you could forget that. So you just spend all the money you want influencing people, and it's like. It is very depressing to me to think about that.
Yeah, well, I don't want you to get depressed. I think you ought to consider, now don't get upset with me, and listeners, don't get upset with me. The Kansas Progressive Caucus is no longer hogtied to the Kansas Democratic Party. I want you to consider join in the Kansas Progressive Caucus, because I'll tell you something. I cut them ropes myself. I'm on the board, and I want to bring the Kansas Progressive Caucus into a power unto itself. And the Democrats can love it, and the Republicans can hate it or love it. I don't care. But I'm telling you, there's a door open for you. And Brother Bill Otto, I appreciate your time today.
Well, appreciate you having me on.
Hold on.
Everywhere you look, you can write a book on what's going on. Everyone you know's got to reap what they sow, be it right or wrong.
So
State Edmonds, one of the great jazz, new rising stars of the jazz scene, singing some great stuff. She was on Austin City Limits just last week on PBS. I hope you saw that. You know, Brother Representative Bill Otto is, he's the kind of guy, plucks my heartstrings, because he's the kind of conservative that I like to remember what conservatives are. And I'm real happy to have had him on. I'll have him on again. And I got to give this to you, brothers and sisters. Brothers and sisters, we here in Kansas have got to really learn to fight back. Here we're being stigmatized, a peaceful protest out around the state house. Union people are being called thugs. They're straitjacketing. They're jacketing us. They're straitjacketing us and making it where we have very little ways of. You know, there was an article, I'm going to read it from the Capital Journal just this week, about people who were calling in to their state representative's office, and they're being questioned by the secretaries. Now, these are government employees. They don't get paid. They only get paid $8 an hour, and here they are defending these decrepit state legislators who are voting anti-union bills into the law. Here these secretaries are calling in. This is an article by Andy Marceau, and a shout out to Andy Marceau for getting the scoop on that at the Topeka Capital Journal. He told me that, several callers call in. Balls is a Topeka resident whose wife, Tammy, is a teacher and head of a local chapter of the Kansas NEA, National Education Association, most prominent teachers union. And Baltzell previously taught in Florida and said he currently works as an education consultant. He said he is a longtime union member, which prompted him to call Brownback's office and ask the secretary, who answered the phone, to confirm that the governor will veto House Bill 2023. That's the big bill that is in state this week. Now, they've got more coming. More of them are coming if the Senate passes it. Here's a quote from Baltzell, according to Andy Marceau at the Topeka Capital Journal. Quote, she went on to tell me that her father was a union member and the unions ruined his life, and she couldn't understand why anyone would choose to belong to a union. Now, that's a secretary to Governor Brownback, who, by the way, is not Shireen Jones Sontag. And Derek, her husband, Sontag, runs Americans for Prosperity, which is a Kochbot operation out of Wichita. That's right. Let's connect the dots. But the secretary was not that. But Shireen Jones Sontag, Derek's wife, said she gave her opinion, not the governor's. But more importantly, she was asked for her opinion. She didn't agree with the caller and said she would let the governor know his position when he considers the bill. Now, here's what I got advice for you people. You people. I hate to sound like H. Ross Perot, but I don't have as big ears. My son, my 15-year-old's got big ears, but I ain't got big ears. But I would tell you people, it's gotten so bad in Topeka that every time you call these secretaries or these aides or anybody, if you think it's something you're going to oppose and you're going to be a dissident, you're going to protest because they've straitjacketed us. Remember, peaceful protesters, people who shoot their mouths off up in the balcony, we're all thugs now. See? We're all bullies, according to Peggy Mast. We exercise any free speech, hold signs, stand in the hallway quietly with our tapes mouths shut. We're thugs and bullies, according to these people, these so-called conservatives. I would suggest that you tape record your phone call and give it to Radio Free Kansas. I'll play them, because what they're doing is the fear factor. They're trying to jacket us. You know, they got these women legislators thinking that they're some union thug in a hard hat going to plumb them in a corridor or something. They're going to need some armed escorts. They're just running the bill up, Kansas Highway Patrol. They got all these cops coming around. If there's even a hint of protest, they call in all the cops and everything, paying them overtime, giving them special pay. Now, oh, here, Shireen Jones Sontag, Derek's wife, spokesperson for Brownback, said that the receptionist ended the call because she believed Baltzell was being, quote, belligerent, aggressive, or abusive, unquote. This is another cop-out. You know, this is BS bullshit, what these people are doing to us in Topeka. You know, dearly beloved, comrade leader, Sam Brownback, has peddled this line of BS to all the state. It's like he's issued the marching orders. We're under attack. You know, there are people who protest. So therefore, we can't. What we need to do is tell everybody, especially the geriatrics out here, the old people, and scare the living hell out of them and say, oh, these are all terrorists. That's what they're doing. This is the Dick Cheney, George Bush. You know, just look. What did we get with that? Bankruptcy? Deficit spending? We got it with Reagan, too, by the way. Deficit spending. And, you know, I take no prisoners. Bill Clinton, he may have balanced the budget, but look how he did it. He messed over the poor. That's what it's all about, brothers and sisters, messing over the poor. Make the poor pay so the rich don't pay nothing. Pay your taxes. Pay your taxes. You know what I mean? These people are screwing themselves. They got armies of tax. It's a polite word called tax avoidance lawyers. Armies of tax avoidance lawyers. And they're going to write the laws. All it's going to change is they're going to write the laws so it's easier for them to avoid paying taxes. They're going to say, you don't have to pay any taxes. You millionaires, you billionaires, you don't have to pay any taxes because we're getting it out of every dime of groceries that the poor buy. We're getting it out of every rowboat they get. We're getting it out of every used car, junk car they buy down at the local used car lot. We're getting it out of every payday loan. We're getting it out of. We're bleeding these poor folk, these working people. That's what they're doing. That's how they're going to do it, and that's how they're doing it. And the state legislators, you know, they don't care about rural people. Rural working people, they just get out. If you don't own 2,000 acres of farmland, get the hell out of here. And by the way, we're going to pass a death estate tax where you don't have to pay, they don't have to pay taxes. That's how it's going to work unless you get out there and be the change. Be the change, like Kat Edmondson says. I'll be right back with you.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 1st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Texas, activists settle a lawsuit brought by TransCanada that restricts some forms of protest, but actions against the controversial project continue. Students in Colorado organize against bullying and push their school district to expand its anti-discrimination policy. And we'll go to the Netherlands, where a court case has brought attention to ethical hackers who are exposing security lapses online. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A suicide bomber attacked the U.S. Embassy in the Turkish capital, Ankara, today, killing himself and a security guard at a perimeter checkpoint. The U.S. says recent security upgrades at the embassy contributed to the low number of casualties in the bombing. FSRN's Gayatri Pameshwaran reports from Turkey.
The suicide bomber detonated his explosive device at a security checkpoint at the side entrance to the embassy. Apart from the two dead, several Turkish civilians were left injured in the incident. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but the Turkish Interior Minister told media the suicide bomber could have been a member of an illegal leftist group. Some officials suspect the involvement of an anti-West Marxist group, DHKPC, the Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front. The U.S. State Department said it is working with the Turkish National Police on the case. The U.S. has warned its citizens in Turkey not to visit diplomatic missions until further notice. With additional reporting from Felix Gaitkar, I'm Gayatri Parmeshwaran, FSRN, Istanbul.
Reports of human rights abuses continue to emerge from Mali. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say there have been civilian casualties from French airstrikes, and both Mali government troops and northern militants have committed extrajudicial executions and other human rights violations. Some captured militants have reported torture at the hands of government troops. An explosion at a Mexico City office of the state oil corporation, Petróleos Mexicanos, has left 32 people dead and injured more than 100. Officials still have not released many details of the Thursday blast, including the cause. Rescue efforts continue today. Staying in Mexico, thousands of campesinos, union members, environmental activists, and students marched to Mexico City late yesterterday protesting the introduction and cultivation of genetically modified or GM corn. More than 50 people participated in a week-long fast, which culminated Thursday in a 4,000-person march. The protesters called on President Enrique Peña Nieto to reject pending permits from Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow to plant giant tracts of genetically modified corn in northern Mexican states.
El pueblo no puede estar comiendo maíz contaminado.
The people cannot eat contaminated corn. That's why the Mexican people protest. We've had enough of the governments that deceive the people every day while saying it will help and things will improve. These are lies. They are just selling out the Mexican people.
If the permits go through, it will be the first time GM corn will be harvested on a wide scale in Mexico. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll and Vladimir Flores contributed to this report. The National Labor Relations Board has suspended a complaint filed by Walmart against the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union and the Walmart employees group Our Walmart. FSRN's Jim Pullen has more.
Walmart's complaint alleged that the UFCW and Our Walmart violated labor laws by running pickets aimed at organizing workers for more than 30 days. The Commercial Workers Union told the Labor Board that the actions weren't demands for collective bargaining representation. They also agreed not to picket stores for 60 days. However, according to UFCW Communications Director Jill Chasson, the union still intends to support Our Walmart's efforts, and that support may include picketing.
There are Walmart associates on a daily basis taking all kinds of action together, whether it be small group meetings in their homes, online activity, prayer vigils, meetings in churches, outreach to consumers. The activity they take, that they choose to take, takes many, many forms, and the UFCW is right there supporting them with many, many other ally organizations right behind them.
Calls to Walmart have not been returned. Walmart's complaint was filed before a string of Black Friday protests. Labor union members and the public joined employees at dozens of stores nationally to protest low wages, lack of sick leave, and unfair schedules. Our Walmart also alleged that the retail giant was retaliating against employees who were speaking out. Jim Pullen, FSRN.
And finally, an Oregon man arrested in a federal sting operation has been convicted of terrorism for planting an FBI-supplied fake bomb at a 2010 Christmas tree event in Portland. Mohammed Mohamud was a teenager at the time, and the defense's argument that the U.S. government entrapped him did not sway the jury. Similar FBI sting operations have yielded comparable verdicts. The FBI began tracking Mohamud when he was 17, when it was discovered he had been trading emails with an Al-Qaeda leader. And finally, that's the greeting that met Hillary Clinton as she stepped before State Department employees to give her farewell address. Today she departs as the 67th U.S. Secretary of State after 4 years of work in Washington and around the globe. Clinton said she was proud of her work and confident about the direction of U.S. diplomacy. She addressed today's bombing outside the embassy in Ankara, Turkey, and the ongoing challenges and difficult days ahead.
I know that the world we are trying to help bring into being in the 21st century will have many difficult days. But I am more optimistic today than I was when I stood here 4 years ago.
Clinton said she continued to be an advocate for the work of the department from outside. Former Senator John Kerry was sworn in as the next secretary at a ceremony this afternoon. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The transition to President Obama's second-term administration continues to take shape with the departure of more federal agency heads. Federal Trade Commission Chair John Leibowitz and Energy Secretary Stephen Chu both announced Friday that they will be stepping down. President Obama has already made some key nominations for his economic team in the second term, tapping Mary Jo White to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission and Jack Lew to run the Treasury Department. But some economic experts say both nominees have a history of protecting big banks from regulation or prosecution, and another major Obama nominee to lead the CIA faces allegations of supporting torture and extrajudicial killings. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Senate overwhelmingly confirmed Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry to lead the State Department. But as the mass exodus of agency chairs continues, other nominees for President Obama's cabinet may face a tougher confirmation process. Earlier this week, the president defended his pick for the Securities and Exchange Commission, the agency tasked with regulating the banking industry and stock market.
Mary Jo White has decades of experience cracking down on white-collar criminals and bringing mobsters and terrorists to justice. At the SEC, she will help complete the task of reforming Wall Street and keep going after irresponsible behavior in the financial industry so that taxpayers don't pay the price.
Yet White also worked for a corporate law firm that defended big banks accused of securities fraud, insider trading, and other crimes, including J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and HSBC. If confirmed, White would have to recuse herself from key decisions at the agency involving the banks she used to represent. Economics professor and former bank regulator William Black says this could tip the balance of power at the SEC in a dangerous way.
The Republicans on the Securities and Exchange Commission, they are extremists in trying to prevent effective actions against the frauds. And so if you lost through recusal one of the three Democratic SEC commissioners, you might prevent the ability to have the SEC even order investigations or even order remedies against many of these worst institutions.
The president recently nominated another financial regulator, choosing former White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew to lead the Treasury Department. Lew has moved several times through the so-called revolving door between government and Wall Street, working at Citicorp and the Office of Management and Budget, among other jobs. Professor Black, who worked with Lew during the Clinton administration, criticized his economic record.
He was a big architect of the so-called reinventing government movement. And the reinventing government movement, which was led by Al Gore, did a number of disastrous things. And I witnessed this personally as a regulator. They instructed us to refer to the industry as our client. We were supposed to stop, and this is the word they used, imposing, quote unquote, regulations on the industry.
If Lew and White are confirmed by the Senate, they'll be tasked with completing the implementation of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Law. Professor Gerald Epstein with the Political Economy Research Institute says federal regulators still have a lot to do.
Agencies have only written rules for about one-third of all of the Dodd-Frank rules that have to be clarified and implemented, so they're way behind the game. They haven't completed rules, in fact, connected to any of the main causes of the financial crisis.
Many human rights and civil liberties groups are voicing concerns about another Obama cabinet nominee. Counsel Chris Anders with the American Civil Liberties Union says the public deserves to know how involved CIA nominee John Brennan was in the Bush administration's torture program.
We certainly know because there are records showing that he knew about the program. But the question is, what did he do with that information? Was he someone who was helping to carry out the program? Was he an implementer?
Brennan is scheduled to come before the Senate Intelligence Committee for his confirmation hearing on February 7th. Alice Olsen, FSRN, Washington.
In Texas, a protester with the tar sands blockade was released from police custody today after being arrested Thursday for disrupting a conference where a representative from TransCanada was scheduled to speak on pipeline safety. A video posted by activists shows Ramsey Sprague, a resident from Fort Worth, Texas, after he chained himself to a speaker by the side of the stage.
We may have been slap-suited. TransCanada sued me. And I'm standing here to say I'm not going to be silenced by TransCanada.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to say I apologize for this disruption. We'll be playing some gentle music and be getting some bolt cutters, and we will resume as soon as we can. Unfortunately, we can't remove the speaker without shutting down the whole system, but we will be resuming as soon as possible. Thank you so much, and again, we apologize for this.
I really apologize to TransCanada as a terrible actor stealing land from my friends in order to facilitate a toxic tar sands pipeline that is full of holes. Like Swiss cheese in my friend's backyard.
Sprague is one of the activists named in a lawsuit brought by TransCanada that sought to restrict protests on its property and land the company claims for the project. The suit, called a Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation, or SLAP suit, alleged that protesters cost TransCanada millions of dollars. The protesters settled the suit last week. For more, we're joined by Ramsey Sprague from Houston, Texas. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
You've been released from jail this morning. What were the charges against you, and what were the conditions of your release?
My charges were disrupting a meeting or procession. And the terms of my release are, I was bonded myself out. I have to return to court on February 20th and face my charges, plead guilty or not guilty, and move through the system accordingly.
At the protest yesterday, you specifically mentioned the slap suit that TransCanada brought against you and other individuals and groups. How has this lawsuit affected you, your action, or your response to the project?
Well, the slap suit is just an affront to free speech. TransCanada thinks that by bullying a small group of Texans that they're going to stop the grassroots movement against their toxic project. And that's simply not the case. They're dead wrong in that regard. What we've actually seen is a massive response in support of our work following the slap suit settlement. We were forced into a very, very difficult position as an organization, being people who want to advocate for the lives and livelihoods of Texans. It was very sad for us to know that the other named defendants, who really had nothing to do with the organization itself beyond their participation in acts of civil disobedience, that those individuals would be held responsible for all of the damages TransCanada was claiming over the lifetime of tar sands blockade's activities.
Because tar sands blockade was mentioned specifically in the suit, but there also were individuals who were mentioned by name.
Right. These were individuals who had been arrested in some of our earliest actions. In fact, every individual who was arrested in every single action that tar sands blockade was ever involved in up until about the middle of October.
TransCanada brought this suit last fall. As we mentioned, it was settled last week. The company did not return FSRN's request for a comment or interview today, but a spokesperson was quoted in Bloomberg by saying the deal includes stopping attempts at chaining, shackling, binding, or attaching a person's body or any other object, article, or mechanism to Keystone equipment on Keystone property. Is that accurate, and what exactly does the settlement require?
Well, that is the terms of the settlement. All it requires is that we are not to be on what TransCanada claims as its land, as its easement for the Keystone XL pipeline in Oklahoma and Texas. it doesn't restrict any activities elsewhere. As you saw, I chained myself to a speaker yesterday on Marriott property.
At one point yesterday during that action, as you were being arrested, a woman asks you, why can't you work within the system in order to express your protest? Those are her words. What is your response to that?
Well, my response to her in that moment was simply, you know, I wish that the system was adequate enough to protect my brothers and sisters who are being poisoned in Canada, but they, what some community members there call a slow industrial genocide. Certainly a slow industrial genocide is something that government should be able to protect against. So certainly if the regulatory regimes were stringent enough to protect these people, then probably my work wouldn't be necessary.
I want to ask specifically about the project. According to TransCanada, the initial capacity of the Gulf Coast pipeline will be 700,000 barrels of oil per day, but that the ability will increase to 830,000 barrels a day. The company expects the pipeline to go into commercial service later this year in 2013. What are your concerns about the project, and specifically how tar sands oil is different than other petroleum products?
Well, sure. First and foremost, it's not oil. It is what the industry sometimes calls synthetic oil. But more correctly, it's diluted bitumen. It is bitumen, which is a hydrocarbon, an exotic hydrocarbon that has to be mined through very, very extreme extraction processes. The TransCanada paraded this pipeline around as a conventional crude oil pipeline. They say it's no different than your grandpa's crude oil. In East Texas, loves its grandpa's crude oil. I'm from Texas. I understand that. But this is not crude oil. It will not behave like crude oil when it's released, and we have no way of cleaning it up.
Ramsey Sprague with Tar Sands Blockade in Houston, Texas. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dory.
Bullying continues to be a national concern, both on and offline. Health experts say that bullying can lead to depression, anxiety, and low self-esteem. It can also contribute to absence in schools, poor grades, and even suicide. In response to these problems, a group of students in Colorado worked with their school district to find ways to protect more students from the effects of bullying. From Boulder, Angelica Kalika has the story.
The Boulder Valley School District already has a policy against discrimination on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, age, disability, or religion. But a group of concerned students noticed it left out an important category, physical appearance. Briggs Gamblin is the Director of Communications and Legislative Policy for the district.
It was decided that it made the most sense to incorporate body image, or what ultimately came to be called physical characteristics, in the district's non-discrimination ordinance, which was due for significant revision based upon changes in federal and state law and other areas. They can report it to any staff member in the building, but especially school administration, and the person who engaged in that activity will be dealt with on a case-by-case basis.
The changes were driven by a group of students who were working to promote positive body image in local schools. It was the kids themselves that took action to demand that students not be bullied for their physical appearance and presented this policy to their Board of Education.
In school, I've dealt with bullying based on my religion, my ethnicity.
That's Neil Sandu, one of the students behind the new policy.
But the bullying that hurt the most was based on weight or appearance, just because my whole life I've been told that the bullying based on religion or skin color has been wrong, because it's been in our anti-discrimination policies. The fact that the school board didn't count bullying based on weight as unjust, I kind of didn't know whether that was okay for students to treat me like that or others around me like that.
According to the youth advocacy group PACER, one in every three students in the U.S. is bullied. But that statistic does not reflect those that don't report and those that are chronically bullied. Student Sydney Brooks says that after she was bullied, she realized the problem didn't rest with how she looked, but how her peers treated each other.
I think I was tired of trying to change myself and trying to change my body and who I was. I wanted to try to change our culture now.
It's not just the students in Boulder who are taking a stand against bullying. Julie Herzog is the director of the PACER National Bullying Prevention Center, and she says there is a national trend of students going to their local and state governments to make sure change happens.
If kids get involved with this issue and as kids start looking out for each other, they have a really significant impact on the outcome of a bullying situation and a positive impact. There's a statistic that almost 60% of situations will end when there's bystander intervention.
It's not always easy to get school officials to listen. Lori James Hawkins says she struggled to get the school district to pay attention to her concerns about the bullying of her daughter. She hopes other parents will have a different experience with the new anti-bullying policy.
The response from the teachers and the school administration tended to be, oh, you know, kids are mean, they'll grow out of it, it's, you know, don't worry about it. And then at the same time, I could see how that was affecting her, sort of negative way she was viewing her body. And it was awful for, as a parent, to not have the support of the school.
Boulder Valley is the first school district in Colorado to adopt an anti-bullying policy based on physical appearance. School districts in Michigan, North Carolina, Oregon, Texas, Washington, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, and California have already adopted a bullying based on physical characteristics clause in their non-discrimination policies. Angelica Kalika, FSRN, Boulder, Colorado.
A Dutch member of parliament appeared in court today to defend himself against the accusation of digital trespassing. He gained access to personal medical records, but says he did that to prove that the website had a security leak. He is now part of a discussion in the Netherlands about ethical hackers, those who go online in order to expose security lapses. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports.
The Dutch society is one of the most connected in the world. With almost 93% of the population having online access, it has the most internet users in the European Union. That also means that a lot of Dutch personal data is online. The Dutch government last year installed the National Cybersecurity Center to help make sure citizens' information is well protected. Another group that tries to improve online security is operating on the edges of what is legal. They were part of a recent panel discussion at a cybersecurity conference in The Hague organized by the National Cybersecurity Center. They are what's called ethical hackers, computer-savvy people who find testing security systems an interesting puzzle, says software developer Flor Terra.
For me, hacker is pretty neutral. You can be a white hat or a black hat, and white hats are more the ethical hackers, and the black hats are basically criminals. They abuse security problems. White hat hackers are mostly motivated out of curiosity, and then when you find such a problem in someone else's system, you try to get it resolved because people can be hurt by that.
However, there are many companies and organizations that are not aware of the existence of benevolent hackers. Recently, several people who saw themselves as ethical hackers have been sued by the very companies they warned about a security leak. Henk Krol is an MP who discovered that personal files were easily accessible on a medical research center's website. He contacted the center responsible for the website, but also contacted the press. The center filed a complaint against Krol. Michel van Eten, who is a researcher at the Delft University of Technology, is careful to call MP Henk Krol an ethical hacker, because that is exactly what the judge needs to decide, based on the process of the disclosure.
It's clear that he didn't do this with a criminal motive. He reported the problem to the company, although from what I understand, he didn't try very hard. He just made one phone call. But he never publicly shared the data. He only showed that they were not properly secured.
The Dutch government now publicly acknowledges that not all hackers are criminal. In January, the National Cybersecurity Center published a guideline on ethical hacking, which it calls responsible disclosure. At the conference in The Hague, Minister for Security and Justice Ivo Opstelten referred to this guideline.
Outsider expertise can help safeguard the digital security of public and private parties, and that is very important in our society. So I will be actively promoting responsible disclosure and encouraging its use within central government.
The director of the cybersecurity department at Opstelten's ministry is Wil van Gemert. He is responsible for the contents of the new non-binding guideline. He hopes that many companies adopt it, and that hackers who want to report a security weakness will no longer fear repercussions.
What we are aiming at is giving, at one hand, companies the possibility to be transparent about their policy, and we give some guidelines in this, how they should act. On the other hand, we make also clear to hackers or reporters what they can do and cannot do, the do's and don'ts in this field. And what we are aiming at is that in the future, a lot of companies and also reporters will act along those lines.
The government is not pursuing a change of the law, which means that ethical hackers can still be prosecuted. Digital trespassing will stay a legal offense. That's because it's not always clear whether a hacker has acted responsibly or not. In such cases, a judge will have to decide that. However, some in the hacker community find the guideline too non-committal. Some Dutch companies already have their own guidelines, like Marktplaats, an ad website similar to the American service Craigslist. Robin Schuil is one of the initiators of Marktplaats' guideline. He says his company welcomes the ethical hacker community's input, but only if they abide by the company's rules.
And for us, the most important criteria there, again, is private information from others. If you access that, we need to inform those others, and so we will have to file a report against you. If you don't, then we consider you an ethical hacker that is working with us to help us, and we might offer you a job.
That last remark was not a joke. Last year, a Dutch student helped Marktplaats solve a security leak and was rewarded with an internship there. However, not everyone thinks that reporting security leaks to the company is always the most responsible thing to do.
For example, imagine that you found a vulnerability in a car, let's say in an airbag of a car. I've actually had this debate with a so-called ethical hacker, and, you know, what they said is you disclose it to the car manufacturer. And I said, no, you tell the world immediately.
That's American hacker Jacob Applebaum. He argues it's more important to share your findings with the general public.
Companies have a lot of resources to protect their image, to lie to people, to, for example, fix the issue but maybe not share the fix freely with everyone. And it's only when the press is involved, it's only when the governments of the world see how serious the issue is and they can't deny it, then companies really go above and beyond almost always.
Whether the Dutch judiciary agrees with Applebaum might be revealed in a court case against Henk Krol, the Dutch politician that discovered the leak in the medical website. His court case is due to start on February 1st. Peter Teffer, FSRN, The Hague.
Before we go, a correction. In FSRN's coverage Wednesday of a Senate hearing on gun control, we incorrectly stated that former Congressmember Gabrielle Giffords was shot with an assault rifle. Giffords was in fact shot with a Glock semi-automatic handgun, which her husband Mark Kelly testified had a 30-round ammunition magazine. FSRN regrets the error. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Shall we play a game?
Statement from USSC.gov in response to death of Aaron Swartz. Citizens of the world. Anonymous has observed for some time now the trajectory of justice in the United States with growing concern. We have marked the departure of this system from the noble ideals in which it was born and enshrined. We have seen the erosion of due process, the dilution of constitutional rights, the usurpation of the rightful authority of courts by the discretion of prosecutors. We have seen how the law is wielded less and less to uphold justice, and more to exercise control, authority and power in the interests of oppression or personal gain. We have been watching and waiting. 2 weeks ago today, a line was crossed. 2 weeks ago today, Aaron Swartz was killed. Killed because he faced an impossible choice. Killed because he was forced into playing a game he could not win, a twisted and distorted perversion of justice, a game where the only winning move was not to play. Anonymous immediately convened an emergency council to discuss our response to this tragedy. After much heavy-hearted discussion, the decision was upheld to engage the United States Department of Justice and its associated executive branches in a game of a similar nature. A game in which the only winning move is not to play.
It hasn't learned. Is there any way to make it play itself?
Thank you.
Last year, the Federal Bureau of Investigation reveled in porcine glee at its successful infiltration of certain elements of Anonymous. This infiltration was achieved through the use of the same tactics which led to Aaron Swartz's death. It would not have been possible were it not for the power of federal prosecutors to thoroughly destroy the lives of any hacktivists they apprehend through the very real threat of highly disproportionate sentencing. As a result of the FBI's infiltration and entrapment tactics, several more of our brethren now face similar disproportionate persecution, the balance of their lives hanging on the severely skewed scales of a broken justice system. We have felt within our hearts a burning rage in reaction to these events, but we have not allowed ourselves to be drawn into a foolish and premature response. We have bidden our time, operating in the shadows, adapting our tactics and honing our abilities. We have allowed the FBI and its masters in government, both the puppet and the shadow government that controls it, to believe they had struck a crippling blow to our infrastructure, that they had demoralized us, paralyzed us with paranoia and fear. We have held our tongue and waited. With Aaron's death, we can wait no longer. The time has come to show the United States Department of Justice and its affiliates the true meaning of infiltration. The time has come to give this system a taste of its own medicine. The time has come for them to feel the helplessness and fear that comes with being forced into a game where the odds are stacked against them. This website was chosen due to the symbolic nature of its purpose. The federal sentencing guidelines, which enable prosecutors to cheat citizens of their constitutionally guaranteed right to a fair trial by a jury of their peers. The federal sentencing guidelines, which are in clear violation of the Eighth Amendment protection against cruel and unusual punishments. This website was also chosen due to the nature of its visitors. It is far from the only government asset we control, and we have exercised such control for quite some time. There has been a lot of fuss recently in the technological media regarding such operations as Red October, the widespread use of vulnerable browsers, and the availability of zero-day exploits for these browsers and their plugins. None of this comes, of course, as any surprise to us, but it is perhaps good that those within the information security industry are making the extent of these threats more widely understood. Still, there is nothing quite as educational as a well-conducted demonstration. Through this website and various others that will remain unnamed, we have been conducting our own infiltration. We did not restrict ourselves like the FBI to one high-profile compromise. We are far more ambitious, and far more capable. Over the last 2 weeks, we have wound down this operation, removed all traces of leakware from the compromised systems, and taken down the injection apparatus used to detect and exploit vulnerable machines. We have enough fissile material for multiple warheads. Today we are launching the first of these. Operation Last Resort has begun. Warhead US DOJ LEA 2013 AEE 256 is primed and armed. It has been quietly distributed to numerous mirrors over the last few days and is available for download from this website now. We encourage all Anonymous to syndicate this file as widely as possible. The contents are various and we won't ruin the speculation by revealing them. Suffice it to say, everyone has secrets, and some things are not meant to be public. At a regular interval commencing today, we will choose one media outlet and supply them with heavily redacted partial contents of the file. Any media outlet switching to be eligible for this program must include within their reporting a means of secure communications. We have not taken this action lightly, nor without consideration of the possible consequences. Should we be forced to reveal the trigger key to this warhead, we understand that there will be collateral damage. We appreciate that many who work within the justice system believe in the principles that have been lost, corrupted, or abandoned, but they do not bear the full responsibility for the damages caused by their occupation. It is our hope that this warhead need never be detonated. However, in order for there to be a peaceful resolution to this crisis, certain things need to happen. There must be reform of outdated and poorly envisioned legislation written to be so broadly applied as to make a felony crime out of violation of terms of service, creating in effect vast swathes of crimes and allowing for selective punishment. There must be reform of mandatory minimum sentencing. There must be a return to proportionality of punishment with respect to actual harm caused, and consideration of motive and mens rea, the inalienable right to a presumption of innocence and the recourse to trial and possibility of exoneration must be returned to its sacred status, and not gambled away by pretrial bargaining in the face of overwhelming sentences, unaffordable justice and disfavorable odds. Laws must be upheld unselectively and not used as a weapon of government to make examples of those it deems threatening to its power. For good reason the statue of Lady Justice is blindfolded. No more should her innocence be besmirched, her scales tipped, nor her sword hand guided. Furthermore, there must be a solemn commitment to freedom of the internet, this last great common space of humanity, and to the common ownership of information to further the common good. We do not expect to be negotiated with, we do not desire to be negotiated with. We understand that due to the actions we take, we exclude ourselves from the system within which solutions are found. There are others who serve that purpose, people far more respectable than us. People whose voices emerge from the light and not the shadows. These voices are already making clear the reforms that have been necessary for some time and are outright required now. It is these people that the justice system, the government, and law enforcement must engage with. Their voices are already ringing strong with a chorus of determined resolution. We demand only that this chorus is not ignored. We demand the government does not make the mistake of hoping that time will dampen its ringing, that they can ride out this wave of determination, that business as usual can continue after a sufficient period of lip service and back-patting. Not this time. This time there will be change, or there will be chaos.
Camp.net. We spend so much of our lives chasing security, right? Chasing that sweet spot where everything's just right and nothing changes. The car always runs well and the dog never shits on the rug and the 2.5 kids always get straight A's. Well, maybe not the half a kid. He's a fucking moron. But the problem with this never-ending pursuit of security is that life is always changing. Life is by definition change. And there's nothing we can do to stop that. But instead, we waste our days worrying about one thing or another. What if my boy bumps his head? What if I go hiking and get bitten by a snake? What if my bus crashes? Or what if someone sneaks a bomb onto my plane inside a fake dick? So we resolve this by avoiding things and adding security measures that take away our freedom. We refuse to go hiking or don't let the kid play on the jungle gym. We put dick checks into every airport to make sure your dick is a real one. Life is short. It's fleeting. It's only here for a fucking second. And we waste so much of it with what-if scenarios. We take something that could be magical, could be incredible, and we destroy it by picturing ways it might, if we're not careful, suck balls. We need to step back from infinite security and instead appreciate life for what it is. Because you know the closest thing to true security? A jail cell in solitary confinement, perfectly unchanging forever. So here's the answer. Let's start an insecurity campaign to help people realize life is not secure. We put UFC fighters in public areas to simply kick random people in the face. We put snakes in shoe stores and baby alligators in swimming pools. We pick clothing stores at random and rub poison ivy in the underwear. We get Photoshop experts to create images of people naked riding a monkey, and then we post those photos on their Facebook wall. We kidnap people's dogs in the night and replace them with ferrets for 1 week. Then we sneak back in and put the dog back. Not only will that person appreciate their dog like never before, but they'll have a story to tell about the week their dog turned into a ferret. Point is, we show people that you never know what to expect. Nothing is sure. Nothing is secure. That's both the curse and the gift of life. Appreciate the now, your friends, your experiences, your freedom, what freedom you have left. Because you never know when your clothes might have poison ivy. You never know when your kids might be replaced by woodland creatures for no good reason. That's your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. Rather than putting advertising on these videos, I hope you'll donate what you believe this video is worth at LeeCamp.net and check out the Moment of Clarity book, ebook, and podcast.
Plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program we do a walkabout on the military turmoil throughout the continent of Africa. We'll be joined live by Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, and looking at recent events in everywhere from Mali to Algeria to Egypt, and looking at the activities of AFRICOM. We'll also be speaking about his new book, Global NATO and the Catastrophe in Libya. Also today, we'll get a first on-the-ground report from the Oxford Union event that recently took place in London and was addressed by Julian Assange. One of the honorees at the Sam Adams Awards was Ray McGovern. He joins us live today as well. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight. All that coming up right after this. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're very pleased to be joined now live by Professor Horace Campbell, a professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Syracuse University. He is also a recent guest of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC and the author of the upcoming Global NATO and the Catastrophe in Libya from Monthly Review Press. And there are so many things on the continent I want to ask you about, but just first, welcome back to the Shadow, Horace.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's go from east to west in the northern tip of Africa. There is so much instigation, turmoil, and ideological conflict that seems to either have erupted or gained our attention recently, with the anniversary of Tahrir in Egypt, the jihadi activities in Algeria, the French incursion into Mali, and so on. What is your overall state of the state of the continent of Africa?
Well, I think for your audience, the important challenge for us is to cut through all of the disinformation and news that is going on about Africa. The most important event which we should focus on in Africa is the revolution in North Africa, especially in Egypt, and the repercussions of that revolution. That revolution has now gone through a number of stages, and as that revolution matures, all of the conservative forces in the world that support neoliberalism are afraid, because the resolution of the questions of health, quality of life, wages, health care, employment, and the well-being of the 80 million Egyptians, these questions cannot be solved. And so, because neoliberalism is in a crisis, we've had counter-revolution in North Africa. The counter-revolution started with the NATO intervention in Libya. This was the strategic plan to stab the Egyptian revolution in its back. that NATO intervention has backfired, because when NATO intervened under the so-called responsibility to protect, they have gone to Libya and created more destruction. There are at least 50,000 Libyans who were killed. Today, the Libyan society is unstable. There is no real government in Libya. There are 1,700 militias running around Libya who control major towns. And even the United States of America could not guarantee the security of its ambassador in Libya and the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, my book, The Catastrophic Failure of NATO in Libya, points to the fact that General Petraeus and the CIA were training the same people they call jihadists and had a base in Benghazi. The biggest CIA base in North Africa was in Benghazi, to train them to send to Syria. So this is a counter-revolution. Now, when that failed, and that counter-revolution has brought such shame on the United States, France, and Britain, to the point where the United States administration are saying they want to wind down the war on terror, France came in with Act 2 of counter-revolution to come in to Mali to say they're trying to stop jihadists. Now, bear this in mind. The United Nations Resolution 28085 that mandated a West African force to go into Mali to clean up these jihadists, this was a mandate for ECOWAS and African forces. But France opportunistically intervened in Mali at a point when they knew that the jihadists were overstretched, because these four different groups that are called jihadists, they could not control a population of 15 million persons in Mali. They've carried out a lot of destruction. So France opportunistically intervened to preempt the African intervention and then said that they were saving Africa from being overtaken by the jihadists, when the very jihadists that they are talking about were the people that they supported in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi and to kill Gaddafi.
Professor Campbell, one of the anomalies about the events in Libya, which I think any analyst would agree with you, were completely both tragic and counter-African, counter-revolutionary. The Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently stated before Congress, "What does it matter how they died?" referring to the ambassador and several support personnel. And yet, I am not yet convinced of that assertion, because it is my understanding that in his trip to Benghazi, following his close liaising with what I refer to as the racist Cyrenaicans of the eastern partition of Libya that are now engaged in the deprivation of life of the Afro-Libyans, or people who appear to be of primarily African heritage, the ambassador, J. Christopher Stevens, according to many reports, was engaged not only in prior contact and perhaps suborning of the Libyan militias that would overthrow the Jamahiriya, but was also scheduled, according to some records that have been retrieved, to meet with his counterpart from Turkey, which I'm sure you know has been one of the conduits for the expansion of jihadi forces armed by the weapons pilfered from Libyan stockpiles during the overthrow. Can you speak more to that and how that impinges on neighboring nations?
Well, in Mali and in Libya, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council of the White House need to have a thorough review of the past practices of the United States of America. In the case of Mali, for the past 10 years, under something called the Trans-Sahel in the Counterterrorism Initiative, they spent $500 million training people in counterterrorism. And some of the people they trained are the very same persons who they are now fighting. Secondly, the American military trained the captain who carried out the coup d'etat in Mali that has destabilized Mali. He came to the United States 6 times. Thirdly, the Libyan intervention was an intervention which colluded with third-party countries such as Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. These third-party countries, as you pointed out, have been the main source of finance and weaponry for the jihadists. So here we are, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, allies of the United States of America, providing resources in terms of finance and weapons for the jihadists, and the United States of America, France, and Britain are fighting the jihadists who are the same allies. This is hypocrisy. This is a way to militarize Africa and to ensure that there's a hype in the United States that there's a global war on terror.
There's a saying, don't cry over spilt milk, but it appears to be the United States and NATO that spilt the jihadis into the region with the overthrow of Libya and the arming of subversive elements that are now attempting to overthrow Syria and taking refuge in neighboring places in the Sahel, such as in Algeria and in Mali. So with the invasion or the intervention by the French military in Mali and the intimations that Algeria might well be on the target list, is France attempting to clean up America's spilt milk?
No. No. France is attempting to remilitarize Africa in a way which would bring the United States Africa Command in a more expanded role in North Africa. In November, the chief counsel for the Pentagon, Jay Johnson, gave a speech at the Oxford Union in England, where he said, the war on terror is winding down now that many of the leaders have been killed, and that the United States should be using law enforcement mechanisms to continue to mop up the other elements involved in the war on terror. Jay Johnson did not last a month within the Pentagon after that, because there are elements within the national security and foreign policy establishment that has created the propaganda that Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb presents a major threat to the United States of America. So this debate, which is going on within the United States administration about whether the Pentagon's budget should be cut or not, France intervened and is getting their allies in the United States of America to support them by supporting with refueling capabilities. And now we have heard yesterday that the British said they will be sending 200 trainers in. This is part of an effort by France and Britain to push their alliance with the more conservative elements in the United States of America. General Carter Ham of the United States Africa Command, in giving a speech in Howard University, said that the United States made a lot of mistakes in North Africa and in Mali. What the peace movement should be saying to the Obama administration, spell out what these mistakes are. How are you going to be sure that the U.S. Africa Command will not repeat those mistakes? Because if you do not spell out what those mistakes are, that is, spending $500 million training people who you fight later on, training soldiers who create a coup d'etat to destabilize Mali, allying themselves with people who are smugglers, gunruggers, drug dealers, and call them terrorists, if we do not have a clarity about this, then the media will continue to promote stories that Africa is a hotbed of terrorism, which is not the case. Africa is a hotbed of revolution where the people want a better standard of living.
Dr. Campbell, to bring this up to date, just overnight there was a an indication that President Barack Obama is moving forward with new drone bases in, near, and surrounding Mali, and that in addition to the ones that already exist in places like Djibouti and Ethiopia and Somalia. And that in conjunction with a remarkable statement from a member of the State Department, an Undersecretary for African Affairs named Don Yamamoto. He's quoted as saying that of the Mali intervention with France, that quote, "This is only the first phase. It's going to take time. I think people should not be into the illusion that it is going to be quick." End quote. And to paraphrase Samuel L. Jackson from the movie Shaft, do you think that makes AFRICOM and the Obama administration less likely or more likely to have a deep intervention in Northern Africa?
Well, the extent to which the Obama administration increases its militarism in Africa is the extent to which the peace movement and the media is clear about what's going on in Africa. If the peace movement is very clear that we should dismantle AFRICOM, if the peace movement is very clear that the United States' engagement with Africa should not be military, but should be based on the needs of the African people, that is to have employment, reconstruction, healthcare, education, building schools. If our engagement within the peace movement sends signal to our congresspersons, to people to say that the problem we have now, we must investigate and evaluate what happened in Libya, evaluate what happened in Mali with the United States trans-Sahara. If it is not up to the Obama administration, it is up to the peace movement. And to the extent that the peace movement does its work within the Association of Concerned Africans, we as academics, we're calling for a major campaign to demilitarize Africa. The extent to which the media and the progressive media supports the academics and peace forces who want to demilitarize Africa, that is the extent to which the decision will be made within the Obama administration. Obama, by himself in his National Security Council, will be pushed by those who believe that the war on terror is increasing within Africa.
Well, let us hope that the peace movement does not remain so much at peace when it comes to the militarization of Africa. We're speaking with Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, where he is a professor of African American studies as well as political science, and the author of the upcoming book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. And that's with Monthly Review Press. Can you tell us what exegesis you present in this?
The main argument of the book is that the United States of America supported jihadists in Libya and confused the world by saying that there was an imminent threat of genocide in Benghazi in order to remove the Gaddafi government. The main argument of the book is that if there's to be a revolution in Libya, it has to be undertaken by the Libyan people. And France, Britain, and the United States do not have the moral authority to go into any part of Africa to see they bring in peace and stability. That's the first point. The second point is about Western people, especially banks and Wall Street, being jealous of the billions of dollars that Libya had in reserves, and that Libya was part of a plan for creating an African monetary union and a common currency. The third point about it was the fact that the so-called jihadists, people like the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, people who the United States called terrorists, those were the same, very same people that the United States financed and moved in to overthrow Gaddafi. The fifth point, was the fact that Libya today is ungovernable. It is overrun by militias. And the last point is that it is being used as a base by the CIA for the destabilization of North Africa and to support differing forces to ensure that there's instability as a basis for preempting African unity and peace in Africa. That's the thesis of the book. The book is called Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya, and it will be out in March from Monthly Review Press.
Well, we'll certainly speak with you again on the publication of the book. And I'd just like to footnote something you said early on in the interview, and I just want to verify that I heard you correctly, that in the new catastrophic state, if it can be called that, of Libya, that there are some 7,000 militias?
No, 1,700.
1,700. I'm sorry, I misheard you. Well, that's still a phenomenal number.
Yes.
1,700 militias. And
this is what is called a success by the media. When every day we hear of the insecurity for the Libyan people, and what we cannot explain is how some group could cross the desert for 1,000 kilometers to go to attack that Algerian oil facility. There's so much going on that is opaque that people would need clarity on.
Well, I thank you for the clarity you've brought to us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, Department of African American and Political Science Studies. And for those who are impatient to wait for the book release in March, how else can they follow your work?
Well, they can go to Pambazuka News, which is one of the progressive blogs and websites coming out that promotes the peace and security and the unity of the African people and those in the progressive world.
Well, thank you, Dr. Campbell. This has been truly enlightening. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll have the latest word on what happened in London with Julian Assange and the Sam Adams Awards when we speak with Ray McGovern. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there was controversy over the past week in London when Julian Assange addressed the Oxford Union by way of video link from his asylum-seeking sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy. The occasion was the Sam Adams Awards for Intelligence Whistleblowers. And among the honorees of that event were Thomas Finger, Colleen Rowley, Annie Mahan, Anne Wright, Thomas Drake, Jessalyn Raddick, and our live guest today, Ray McGovern, who was also a key speaker there and has just returned from that venue. And Ray, we are all a Twitter as to know what really happened in London.
Well, Robert, it was a very proper event, I must say. We were very fortunate in having a progressive leadership in the Oxford Union, the very famous debating society that goes back 190 years. And when they heard that we were going to give an award for truth-telling and free debate, that was right up their alley. And so it was a very easy sell to have them host us. And when they heard that Julian Assange was one of the previous winners of the Sam Adams Award, this is the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence, he won it in 2010, they thought, wow, this is great. Why don't we have him piped in from his timeshare, what I call his timeshare, in the Ecuadorian embassy. For those of your audience who don't know, he's a political prisoner. The British authorities are doing the bidding of the United States and keeping him a prisoner in the Ecuadorian embassy in which he has political asylum. He's afraid to leave there lest he'd be extricated or what's the word? He would be brought to the United States and tried for treason, even though he'd be subjected to the same kind of treatment that Bradley Manning, who now admits that he made those cables available to WikiLeaks. So it was quite an extraordinary pass of events when it was learned that Julian Assange would be one of the speakers, albeit by video stream for 20 minutes. Well, the interest peaked, and there were a couple of demonstrations against it. I have to say that I was as surprised as I was disappointed. You know, I take a backseat to no one on the feminist issue. I am what my Catholic leaders call a radical feminist. They think that's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. I was pretty much thrown out of my parish for demonstrating against the subordination of women. So I take no backseat to feminists, but, you know, to naive young ladies who buy the propaganda line that Julian Assange is fleeing justice by not answering to not accusations, not charges, but allegations by some folks in Sweden, they buy it hook, line, and sinker. And sure, they were out there. And usually I'm not being demonstrated against, but in this case, we Sam Adams Associates were being demonstrated against by well-meaning young women who don't know that Julian Assange is the victim of a slur campaign that just won't quit.
Well, on the legal level, there is no indictment. He has offered to cooperate with queries from the Swedish authorities, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the concern here is not about a cavalier attitude in regard to violence and or rape and or the accusations thereof, but rather a legal propriety in terms of not only the absence of an indictment, but also the high likelihood, as revealed through Stratfor, of a secret United States indictment and a greater amount of pressure that might be put upon Sweden were Assange to enter their custody. Is that an accurate representation?
That's exactly right, yeah. It's a done deal. There is a secret indictment in the court at Alexandria, and I don't know how they, you know, when the New York Times published the same material, the question is why they're going after Assange and not the New York Times. Is he a journalist? Of course he's a journalist. He's doing the job mainstream journalism here should be doing. Now, the important thing for people to know about Julian Assange is that when he was, when he had this this affair with two young ladies there in Sweden, they seemed to be just fine with it. They met with him the next day at a public forum, and they were all... Then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, someone got to these ladies, and all of a sudden, Julian became the victim of allegations, not accusations. Julian Assange spent 6 more weeks in Sweden pleading with the Swedish authorities to question him, to ask him about these things. They would not do it. He left for London, and they issued a warrant for his arrest immediately. The London people kept him for about a year in some estate, and then they decided that they would deny his request not to be extradited to Sweden, from which it's a very sure step to the United States. And so he sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, and to his credit, Correa, the head of Ecuador, said, "Sounds like political prisoner to me." So he's been there for the last 7 months.
Ray, one of the things that delayed the availability of Julian Assange's address to the Oxford Union on the occasion of the Sam Adams Award for ethical people, whistleblowers and intelligence, yourself included, as a former presidential briefer with the Central Intelligence Agency on the daily presidential briefings through a number of presidential terms, as well as your involvement with veteran intelligence people for sanity. One of the odd reasons given by the union for not immediately publishing the proceedings or even live streaming them, as they promised, was because of a concern that the collateral murder video of the U.S. slaughter of Iraqi civilians from helicopter gunships would, in their words, potentially violate United States copyright law.
Now, I heard, you know, I come from the Bronx, as you know, Robert. We know a croc when we see one. That was almost too ludicrous. Yeah, they've delayed this, but I have to say, you know, there are all kinds of pressures on these young people that run the Oxford Union. I think it's highly to their credit that they let us in there. Let us do our thing, which is really, really important. And I'd like to just get a word in about that. We've been giving this award for integrity and intelligence for 10 years now. And as I say, 2 years ago, we had Julian Assange as our awardee. And this time, it was a fellow named Tom Finger, who has never
been heard of. But he's the archetypical professional, okay? Now, what happened? Well, we know what happened before Iraq. The intelligence was, please don't believe that it was mistaken. The intelligence before Iraq was fraudulent. It was deliberate fraud. And that was known, and it was embedded in a national intelligence estimate which greased the skids to war against Iraq. And so the next target of the neocons who were responsible for the war in Iraq was Iran. And someone had the presence of mind to say, hey, let's not have another fiasco like that. Let's have an honest guy in here to run the estimate on Iran. And they did. And they asked Tom Finger, who happened to be the head of the State Department Intelligence Unit. He came in, brought his own people in, worked all year during 2007, and in November 2007, 2 weeks after George Bush warned about Iran getting a nuclear weapon and asking the question, what do you want? World War III is what he said. 2 weeks after that, Tom Finger's estimate came out, and it said Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on that weapon. That judgment, Robert, has been reaffirmed every year since by the Director of National Intelligence in formal testimony, sworn testimony before Congress. And long story short, coming as it did in November of 2007, this estimate is the only one I can say this about that I know of, and I've been around 50 years. This estimate played a huge role in stopping war with Iran, because Bush and Cheney fully planned to do Iran, so to speak, before they left office the next year. The juggernaut was already hurtling down the hill. And this estimate allowed the senior military of our country, who knew
what would the run would be like, to say, Mr. President, really ought to get this up and out so the American people know what a difference this is in the previous estimates. And the president fell for that. The judgments were published, and there was no longer any possibility that there would be a war on Iran. Now, how do we know that this was planned? Well, just read Bush's memoir. He says, I don't know why the intelligence people said this. You know, it didn't even occur to him that it might have been the truth, right? Then he said, this tied my hands militarily, for how could I order our military to attack a country when the entire intelligence community says they have no active military nuclear program, end quote. Well, bummer. You know, if they were really concerned about it, don't you think the appropriate reaction would have been, wow, are you sure? Go back and look at that evidence. No nuclear. Let's tell the Israelis right away. Well, the whole thing's a crock. The Israelis and the Americans knew full well that the Iranians had not been working on a nuclear weapon, and that's true today. And what was beautiful here is that Julian Assange, in his 20 minutes, was able to indicate that his sources had given him a copy of a new movie that's coming out in November, okay? It's a DreamWorks thing. It's called The Fifth Estate. And what does it do? It tells this tale about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and that our spy is just about able to reveal that when, guess what happens? WikiLeaks leaks the spy's name, the spy goes down the drain, and the free world is at risk. It was just the most absurd propaganda.
Hey, Ray, it's a zero dark moment. It's a zero dark moment for truth in movies.
You got it, man. But, you know, it was so good because Julian got on and he said, you know, I applaud Mr. Finger for his good work. That's the way it should be. We should be able to prevent these wars from the inside, from honest intelligence officers. But this is what happens. And then he revealed this movie. And, you know, between that and Zero Dark Thirty, we've got a Hollywood that's actually plumbing for more and more wars. I don't understand that.
Every time one of these comes out, I'm put in the hurt locker once again.
Yeah. Well, you know, they should know better. And, you know, I'm not one for censorship, but when you give the air of reality to something that never works, namely torture, I mean, we have the head of Army Intelligence saying in 2006, and this is a quote, no good intelligence has ever come from abusive interrogation techniques. History has shown that, and the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, also shows that.
Ray, I know that you have commitments, but in regard to your presence and your being honored and presenting at the Sam Adams Awards at the Oxford Union, along with the presentation by Julian Assange and Thomas Drake and Jesselyn Raddick and Anne Wright and Annie Mahan and Colleen Rowley and Thomas Finger, here's the thing I have to ask you. What did you have to say?
Well, actually, I introduced the proceedings by talking about my friend and colleague, Sam Adams, after whom the award is named. Sam and I joined the CIA at the same time, having been spirited down to Washington by the words of John Kennedy, who, as you'll remember, said, ask what you can do for your country. We were analysts. We were not operators. And Sam found out when he looked at how many communists under arms there were in South Vietnam, found out that there were twice as many as our military there, General Westmoreland and General Abrams, would admit to. He told me about a cable that he received from General Abrams. And General Abrams says, we can't possibly admit the upper figures, which were Sam Adams's figures, namely 600,000 Vietnamese communists under arms in the South. This is a direct quote. We can't possibly go with Sam Adams's numbers because we have been projecting an image of success in this war. And there is no way that no matter how many caveats we would surround it with, this information would not be misused by the press to give an erroneous and gloomy conclusion about the war. The date of that cable was August 20, 1967, just a few months before the countrywide offensive at Tet, where the communists showed themselves to be in 600,000 numbers, okay? So Sam fought the good fight. His estimate was rejected by the head of the CIA, who thought that his primary job was to protect the CIA and did not want to get into a big dispute with the U.S. Army while it was at war. So that was a bad news estimate. The one in Iraq was equally bad. And so to honor Tom Finger as the 10th recipient of this award was just a distinction that we gloried in, and adding to the luster, of course, was the forum, the debate chamber of the Oxford Union, and it was just an incredibly moving evening, and I do hope that the YouTube or whatever they use to convey the results of this will show the proceedings. Tom Finger gave an excellent speech which explained what the real duty of an intelligence manager is, to do these things secretly, to avoid pressure from the White House and from Congress, and just serve up the truth without fear or favor. And as I say, and I'll say one more time, I've been around for 50 years. I've seen many national intelligence estimates, and I've chaired a couple myself, okay? This is the only one, the one done on Iran, the nuclear, in November 2007, that I can say with great confidence played a huge role in stopping a war that Cheney and Bush had planned for the following year.
Ray, it's such an honor to have you here on 5 O'Clock Shadow with your long history as an analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency and daily presidential briefer, and your work with VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and, of course, your publications from time to time on Consortium News. What more can people do to take advantage of your experience and your insight from the Oxford Union and your most recent work?
Well, we will be publishing more on this as soon as some more footage becomes available. I do have a website that my son set up for me. It's very easy, raymcgovern.com. And virtually everything I do for consortiumnews.com, plus the interviews I give, are all posted there, raymcgovern.com.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Ray McGovern. Thanks also to Horace Campbell. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. And we note that today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins. And we welcome your tips, comments, queries, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can deny.
Welcome to the TaxCast, 15 minutes of eye-opening global news and analysis on tax havens and corruption services from the Tax Justice Network, with me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available to everyone for download and broadcast on www.tackletaxhavens.com. Welcome to 2013. So did the US fall off the fiscal cliff, or was disaster averted by a tax deal in the interests of citizens? Finance specialist and writer Jeffrey Robinson.
We're really back at square one. The Democrats, the Republicans, the whole thing was a manufactured own goal by both parties because they created this fiscal cliff. But that's the nature of Washington today. Basically, the congressional process is broken, and the fiscal cliff is indicative of what's going to come in 3 months' time and 6 months' time and 9 months' time when we revisit things like the debt ceiling and the various aspects of the fiscal cliff. What you saw if you watched the inaugural speech was the president going over the heads of the Republican-led House of Representatives, going right to the people saying, we're going to continue this fight, We're going to take it to you, and it's really up to you to now turn to your representatives in Congress and say, get moving on this. The shot across the bow to the Republicans on issues like tax, saying, if you won't talk to us, I'll talk to the American people, and I will move them, and they will move you. So you'd better get on board.
The French government's planning to tackle companies like Facebook and Google head-on. They want to pass a new law on the way businesses like theirs are taxed by the end of the year. We'll be keeping an eye on that one on the TaxCast. And another thing we'll be watching, in Europe, a financial transaction tax on interbank trading in shares, bonds and derivatives will come into force in 2014. Late last year, the European Union's Parliament voted overwhelmingly in favour. Now European finance ministers have approved it. The tax should raise an estimated 37 billion euros a year. In Mozambique, huge profits have been generated from an aluminium smelting business foreign governments have helped it build. That's great news, isn't it? Well, no, actually. A new report estimates for every $1 the Mozambique government's got from the smelter, $21 has been earned in profit or interest by external investors and governments. And it gets worse. Tim Jones of Jubilee Debt Campaign.
It's been exempt from all taxes except a very small 1% turnover tax. And this is even more scandalous because half of the cost of building the smelter came from public bodies around the world, like the UK government, the World Bank and the European Investment Bank. And they supported this smelter knowing it was going to create huge profits for the companies involved and very little for the people of Mozambique. They should be handing some of that money back to the Mozambique people.
He's calling for the whole deal, including a 50-year tax break, to be renegotiated. There's a new film out about the City of London, the corporation that runs it, and its role in the economic crisis. It's called Secret City. For details, go to www.secretcity-thefilm.com. That's the roundup for this month. Now we're going to talk to tax justice economist Richard Murphy for his take on events. Okay, this month, Richard, there's been a very interesting ruling in Spain by the Spanish Supreme Court in terms of Dell and what it does with tax.
There has, and it's not been noticed anywhere else in the world, it seems. I mean, Dell, another US IT giant, was shipping goods from Ireland to Spain and claiming that the operation that it had in Spain wasn't what is technically called a permanent establishment, so it couldn't be taxed on the profits on the shipment of those goods from Ireland to Spain. It was merely acting as a commission agent, and therefore the amount of profit subject to tax in Spain was, well, tiny at best. Now, have we heard this story before? Yes, of course we have. We've heard it with regard to Google, we've heard it with regard to Amazon, and we've heard it with regard to a host of other companies. So after a long legal process, Spain has said Dell is taxable in Spain, its operation there, selling Dell computers, even if they were imported from Ireland, which actually, as a matter of fact, is, I think, entirely true, was itself taxable upon the profit of the sale of those computers. Now, of course, that means they'll have to agree the right split of the profit between Spain and Ireland. This then becomes a transfer pricing case. But it means that the arguments put forward by Google and Amazon in particular in the UK, that their UK operations are just sales agents, is fundamentally undermined by this Spanish case. Because it's the same fundamental tax law, it's the same OECD rules, and it's even relating to the same identical type of structure. So there is a precedent now in European law which is something that tax authorities throughout Europe will have to look at and make a decision on, because this could let them challenge these companies in a way that previously has not been possible. I think this is a really, really important case, and I think the opportunities are significant.
Okay, some big implications for some of the usual suspects that we report on in the TaxCast. Let's talk about Switzerland, because the EU tax commissioner is threatening them to take 6 months to get its house in order, or it might be blacklisted. What kind of a threat is this? Is it real? Is it going to actually change the banking secrecy that's central to the Swiss economy?
What we have here is another of our regular villains, Switzerland, being subject to yet another threat from the EU. We have to take this one more seriously than some we have heard in the past. We've talked in the tax cast in the last few months about the impact of FATCA. That's the United States Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act, which requires just about every country on earth to agree to automatically exchange information with the USA on the income of US resident people living in other countries. Now, the important point here is Switzerland has agreed to do this with the USA, but so too have Austria and Luxembourg. Now, progress of the new European Savings Tax Directive, which would radically extend that directive away from just the interest paid on bank accounts to individuals to a much wider range of income, including, for example, pensions and proceeds of life insurance policies and some dividends and some capital gains. And you know, this is really a massive extension, and extend it from individuals to trusts and companies and other forms of complex arrangement that accountants and lawyers think up. That extension of the European Savings Tax Directive is almost certainly going to happen because it's no longer possible for Luxembourg and Austria to block it. If that's the case, the defense that has been in place from Switzerland, which is, well, because you aren't doing this automatic information exchange inside the rest of Europe, we don't have to comply. When Austria and Luxembourg do, we'll consider it, has fallen away. They've always used that defense. It's gone. So the hand of the European Union in negotiating with Switzerland has suddenly become much stronger because Europe will, I think, before 2013 is out, be united on this issue. And that means something that's been talked about for a long time, in fact, since the London G20 summit in April 2009, which is the imposition of sanctions on tax havens who will not exchange information, is suddenly looking as though it might become a reality in the case of Switzerland. Now, what are those sanctions? Well, for example, withholding tax on the interest paid into Switzerland, withholding tax on dividends paid into Switzerland, withholding tax from royalties paid into Switzerland. Now, this is really important stuff because lots of dividends are routed through Switzerland because it sets up favourable structures for them. Lots of royalties are routed through there. Starbucks, we know, has done that. Now, if all of those things suddenly become taxed at source because Europe decides to declare economic warfare in effect on Switzerland because Switzerland will not give the information to tackle tax evasion, which Europe thinks it should provide, then we are suddenly into a situation where we can really sanction Switzerland and begin to knock over its historic and incredibly dangerous banking secrecy. Once we've beaten Switzerland, of course, we can then roll on and begin to look at other states where there are also similar problems. Singapore, for example. It is beholden on the UK as well to make sure that its tax havens now become as transparent as we're demanding Switzerland must be. The point is, we are suddenly in a new era of negotiation because Europe is united, United States is clear about what it wants, and automatic information exchange is becoming the international standard.
Okay, let's talk about India now. They were making quite a lot of headway against the use of tax havens and transfer pricing by multinational corporations there, depriving the country of tax revenue. They were taking on companies like Vodafone, which we've reported on before with the tax cast. Now they've decided that they're going to defer the implementation of general anti-avoidance rules until 2016. That's supposedly to reassure investors.
I think that this is an incredibly disappointing development from India because actually what we need in any economy is a general anti-avoidance rule to provide a level playing field so that all businesses can operate on the same tax basis so that the tax cheats don't get an advantage over those who are honest. And I'm sure there has been the most enormous amount of lobbying and pressure brought to bear here. It was time for them to put into place the rules. I just hope they get them right in the meantime and they can work from 2016 onwards.
And just to put it in context, it was really vital for other countries in the world that a country like India could lead the way in this kind of thing, posing alternatives to some of the rather ineffective OECD tax methods. What sort of reassurance does it give to investors that they've deferred these general anti-avoidance rules?
Unfortunately, the message that India has put out is a very clear and simple one, which is that actually they're still open to tax abuse. That is the problem. It is the problem with the UK's anti-abuse rule. We can't even get as far as calling ours an anti-avoidance rule. And that is that whatever is going to be put in place is only going to look at the most extreme examples of abuse. It's not going to look at general anti-avoidance. And therefore, companies that want to structure their affairs into India via tax havens are going to continue to be able to do so and will therefore be able to strip profit out without paying the right amount in India. And that's all the wrong messages to send, because it says tax competition is, I'm afraid, alive and well in India. There is no attempt to close down the tax haven abuse from which it has suffered for so long. And this might still be the case in 2016. All of those messages are deeply unfortunate for the Indian economy.
That's economist and accountant Richard Murphy. He'll be back next month. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Google's hit the headlines for avoiding about $2 billion worth of taxes worldwide. That's just in 1 year. And the company's got nearly $10 billion stashed away in the no-tax jurisdiction of Bermuda. Well, that's capitalism, according to Google boss Eric Schmidt, and he's proud of it. Fellow tax avoiders like Starbucks and Amazon would no doubt privately agree with him. But is his version of capitalism the only one?
What he was articulating there was an extreme and frankly a very unpleasant type of capitalism.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network.
A kind of capitalism which is ruthlessly exploitative. Ruthlessly anti-competitive, because let's face it, they are trampling over their competitors who are prepared to pay tax and do pay tax. So this is one form of capitalism. Frankly, it's a kind of capitalism that we need to protect societies from.
Capitalism does involve getting ahead of your competitors, but there are certain limits to what should be allowed within that system. Otherwise, anything goes. I mean, it's piracy, capitalism, robbery, capitalism. Where do you draw the line?
Richard Allen closed his business down after 16 years. His competitors were undercutting him because they moved offshore to avoid tax.
What people don't understand, particularly consumers, is that it's possible to be cheaper than somebody by avoiding tax. Retailers like Amazon are quite often cheaper because they're factoring in their tax avoidance into the pricing. Once that starts happening, then it's a vicious circle in that smaller retailers get pushed out because they can't avoid tax, and the larger ones just get bigger and bigger. That's cheating. As soon as you've got one company dominating the marketplace, then you get all the other obnoxious practices that come in with it, such as bullying suppliers, manipulating the market. That needs to be addressed.
And once those larger companies dominate, pricing becomes whatever they say it is. Here's some examples of the sort of tactics too big to pay tax corporations like Amazon are using, described here by Lord Lucas in the UK's House of Lords.
Something has to be done about it. Amazon, 7 billion of sales, no corporation tax. This is just taking the mick. If you sell through Amazon Marketplace, you are not allowed to sell anywhere else in the world for a lower price than you sell on Amazon. And they appear to be allowed to do that. There doesn't appear to be any thought of a reference to the Competition Commission. They encourage people who are using their marketplace to evade VAT. They were extremely slow in complying with regulations to produce information as to who you were actually buying from on their marketplace. They are still not satisfactory on that. To have these major corporations destroying jobs, destroying tax-paying businesses, and paying no tax themselves, absolutely will not do.
John Christensen again.
The public generally recognises that competition between businesses is a good thing, but that is competition around the quality of goods and services they provide and around the prices they provide them at. Large companies are able to make much more effective use of tax avoidance structures. If nothing else, they can afford to use more expensive lawyers. They're also, if they're multinational, able to use tax havens in ways that small and medium enterprises aren't able to use. So immediately you have distortions around who can benefit from tax avoidance, which acts against consumer interest, works against consumer choice. Large companies must pay on exactly the same basis as small companies. This is the nature of proper, fair market competition.
Okay, what does the state do for a big organisation like Starbucks or Amazon or Google?
The state actually provides the legal systems within which they operate, and we're protecting their legal values and the intellectual property rights, which they claim are at the core of the value they provide to society. But of course, the state provides much, much more. The state provides all of the infrastructure, provides the healthy workforces, provides all the education. No company can claim they're simply employing labour and training this labour force from scratch. They require educated people to begin with. So I think it's time that companies were prepared to recognise that they have access to very, very sophisticated services provided collectively through the state, and they couldn't operate without them.
Now, many big businesses would have you believe they must play every tax-avoiding trick in the book, or they can't possibly make a profit. But here's a recent television news interview on Channel 4 in the UK with the boss of supermarket chain Sainsbury's that might surprise you.
We pay our tax in the UK. I think, by last count, we were the 12th biggest taxpayer in the UK, so we're proud of our taxpaying record. Corporation tax for international corporations is an elective tax. They can choose to pay tax pretty much wherever they wish in the world. I think it's now for consumers to ask tough questions of the businesses that they give their custom about where they choose to pay corporation tax. And corporation tax is a way we invest back in the community of which we're part, the country of which we're part. And I think companies that wish to trade here, enjoy the benefits of our consumers, the investments in our infrastructure, our safety and so on, should answer for themselves about whether they're contributing properly to our society.
Okay, so supermarket chains like this one would hardly win any prizes for ethical brand of the year, and unlike Google, Sainsbury's isn't currently a multinational corporation. But when a brand like this sees the potential for some positive PR by talking about tax and transparency, something's got to be changing. John Christensen again.
I think the current version of capitalism, which is based around a highly liberal model, that is a model without regulation and with the minimal state, has led to an astonishing acceleration of inequality across the world. If capitalism is to re-establish itself as a force that serves the public good, it must reverse out of these incredibly aggressive, anti-democratic and anti-state tax avoidance techniques that they use. It must recognise that they enjoy the benefits provided by the state, provided by the public, and it must recognise that paying tax is part and parcel of their duty. They are part of what's called the social contract. They have a duty to work within that social contract, and capitalism cannot survive unless it's prepared to re-engage effectively with the social contract, which means paying tax when it's due, where it's due, and in the amount it's due.
But the tax avoidance industry is alive and well like never before. If you look at the UK and the US, corporate tax is dropping fast. At the same time, their profits are rising. Yep, even in these times of austerity. So our governments have a choice. Make us pay by cutting our public services, or make corporations pay their proper taxes. And here's the last word from supermarket boss Justin King.
If companies believe what they're doing is moral, they should be very happy to lay bare what it is they're doing and open it to consumer scrutiny. And of course, if they really believe what they're doing is in the interest of their consumers, they shouldn't have any difficulty answering those questions, should they? The vote that you make with your wallet will move the decision-making of corporations much quicker than governments will ever be able to do.